a lot of content and, you know, interviews with you, and I read a lot about you, and, you know, like, I think that, you know, we all have like skeletons in our closet, right? So like I've brought kind of my skeleton, and I like, you know, so put it, but that part of the story, you know, when you said, I heard it a few times, the Coca-Cola of gaming, of iGaming, there's so much pride there. And this is something that I think like often we miss in iGaming, like people always somehow almost like an underlying of a bit of shame.
Internet changed. I'm sorry, that was my phone alarm to wake me up for this call.
For this call,
I'll go back. Not everybody categorizes gaming / gambling as entertainment. Some people see it as a sin. Now, I believe that everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but they're not entitled to tell me what I should do or what I should not do within the parameters of reasonable legislation. The other thing I think is that I have said before, and I still feel the same, and no disrespect to the authority or the group of industry people you were talking about. The industry is naive and lazy, and the real leaders of this industry do not talk enough.
Welcome to IGB Podcast, iGaming Checkup with Dr. Eyal, brought to you by IGB in partnership with Replay. I'm Dr. Eyal. I've been passionate about games and the people that makes them for many years. Humans have been playing games of chance even before we could write. So what is going on here? Why gambling games are so central to our experience as a species? And why is something as simple as a slot machine is also the hardest game to make? Sure, there are plenty of iGaming podcasts out there covering industry trends and headlines. But this isn't just more of the same. We are here to challenge assumptions, invite sideways thinkers and industry outsiders, and explore the complexity of an ever-evolving, fascinating, and innovative space. If you are ready to think differently about iGaming, you are in the right place. Let's go. I'm joined by David Karatas from David Karatas Consultancy. This episode is, we call it White is the New Black. We're going to be talking about regulation in iGaming and the personal impact of regulation in the iGaming. And David, I've watched a lot of content and, you know, interviews with you, and I read a lot about you. And, you know, like, I think that, you know, we all have like skeletons in our closet, right? So like I've brought kind of my skeleton, and I like, you know, so put it, but what I found about you and your story, which is it's an amazing story, is that you would have done nothing different. You're very proud of the experience and what it taught you. So I thought maybe we can just start by, maybe you can tell us a little bit about, you know, about the history of, you know, bets on sports and your experience back in the about 20 odd years ago.
Okay. First of all, thank you for inviting me to talk. And thank you very much for depicting me as someone as handsome as that young man you just showed on the screen a moment ago. Looks very familiar. You're right. It's coming up 26 years when disaster struck. But prior to disaster, there was an amazing amount of joy, learning, happiness, exposure, excitement, adrenaline. You know, I went to Costa Rica in 2000 and I started Bet on Sports with the founder. And together with a lot of hard work, we transformed that from a family business that was just a bookie into a global player, into what we were visioning to be the Coca-Cola of online gambling.
I love that about that part of the story. You know, when you said, I heard it a few times, the Coca-Cola of gaming, of iGaming, there's so much pride there. And this is something that I think like often we miss in iGaming. Like people always somehow almost like an underlying of a bit of shame and, you know, working in iGaming. And then Coca-Cola of iGaming, it's such a powerful statement to say about the company, about a project that you're leading. So I really love that statement. And
number one, it was true. It was true. Number two, it was based on my experience to date at that point. I echo your frustration with the industry not having quite the echelon of reputation that it deserves. You know, I joined the industry in 1976, April 6, 1976, and I worked for a brand that is now minimized. It's called Ladbrokes. But back in the day when I was with Ladbrokes, we were the Coca-Cola of online gambling, but only in the United Kingdom. And I started in Ladbrokes in 1976, April the 6th, 1976. I'd gone through the trauma of working for a bookmaker. Nobody else had a university degree. Nobody was thought of as a businessman. You were a bookie. And the internet gave us all an opportunity to transform the industry and make the industry global. My experiences in Costa Rica showed me the capacity and the opportunity to do that. And as part of the vision and idea for listing the company in London, which we did in 2004, was to globalize the enterprise. And that was my vision. And I actually did it before 2006. You know, I was the first white person to buy Asian-facing businesses from Asian people. That is monumental. Not many people know that. So I was before my time. I was before my time for regulation. I was before my time for vision. I wasn't before my time for Aviator, but I wish I had been.
You know, if we had the time machine. The thing is, you had a really good, I've watched a really good interview you had with Pierre Lindt, and you talk about that experience in 2006. And you know the arrest, and then and the 5 years. I think it's five and a half years ordeal that followed. What struck me there, and in context of regulation, and I would really like for you to say a few words about maybe that experience. But that everything was after the effect. So we have a successful public company that is doing that. That is very honest about its operations. It's a public company. You have to report things. You have to go to licensing. You know, it's not in a vacuum, right? And then legislation changed, and then we go back in time, and all of a sudden what we've done backwards becomes a challenge. So that to me was very scary. It's a very, very, very scary concept of that ability of time travel in a way where a regulator can do it, but not, you know. So what's your perspective on that and on that experience?
Well, first of all, we did everything we needed to do to comply to list the company. You know, the microscope that goes across everything is phenomenal. And we had legal opinions. We had legal opinion that was published. It's in the prospectus. It says, this activity in the United States may be illegal. So it was something we were cognizant of. But we had a defense. We've never tested that defense. Because to test that defense, the risks to the individual are phenomenal. The defense, in a short story, is that in 1989, the US government signed a GATT agreement, a general trade agreement. That general trade agreement was signed with Antigua. It was categorized as leisure services. Under the World Trade Organization, leisure services include gambling. Bet on Sports had a gaming license in Antigua. Therefore, it had the right to penetrate and do business in the United States. That's what we did. That was in the public domain. But I knew and was aware that if we had what happened in 2018, had happened in 2005, my share price would have doubled. And I actively engaged with decision makers, influencers, politicians, the public in the United States from 2004 until 2006. Effectively, that did not make me a hero. It made me a target for people who objected to the industry. And I was then used as an example not to follow. Now, what is frustrating today about all of that is, one, they did introduce legislation eventually. Two, they only introduced state legislation. Three, they're still chasing the black market. And the black market still represents 40, 50, maybe 60% of the market. And there are still arguments about what's a sports bet, what's a contract, what's a casino, et cetera, et cetera.
I think, yeah, like it seems that a lot of the, you know, a lot of the debates in politics exists in that gray area of the definitions, right? So it's not that straightforward. That's kind of like where a lot of business opportunity exists as well. But I think, you know, like for me at RubyPlay, we're in the process of opening in the US, in the different states. And I know at the personal level, the amount of due diligence is happening. Like I had to tell agencies in the US, essentially, everything that I've done from the age of 18, everything, where I lived, where I worked, what I studied, all, everything, my bank accounts, everything. That level of due diligence it blew my mind, really. And the thing is, you know, what I think that many people outside of the industry, when have like they have an opinion about iGaming, they miss is that level of due diligence that's happening, and it's happening, you know, like with in a way that for players in the iGaming you know business, we welcome that. No, we welcome that level of regulation. So I think there's a few elements to look at here. So first of all, what do you think drives the point of view of regulators in that respect, in a way of almost like trying to push against iGaming rather than work with it, and what kind of, you know, what kind of attitude you can expect from different regulators?
First thing, and it's the obvious thing, but that due diligence is an effective barrier to entry. So therefore, it is something that a nationalistic regulator can use to enhance opportunity inside his own jurisdiction or her own jurisdiction. Secondly, it's not uncommon nowadays for other things and everything, financial transactions and all the rest of it. So I don't see the inspection as a problem. I see the inspection as a necessity. But what I see as the problem is the naivety, the ignorance, the confusion, the political motivation from some regulators.
So, you know, like I look at to connect to that, there's I think maybe a couple of weeks ago the Betting and Gaming Council presented to in the UK. I think it was a Granny Host, I hope I'm not butchering her name, that actually presented to the Treasury Select Committee, and she talks about taxing in the UK and the idea of increasing tax, and she's saying, look, EY presented reports about this. If we're going to increase tax, it's going to have a negative impact on everything. It's going to have negative impact on 40,000 jobs that might get lost. It's going to increase black market wagering, but I think she said something like £8.5 billion. £8.5 billion. So to connect to what you're saying, it's I find it sometimes strange, almost like don't regulators see this point? And one of your interviews back in 2004, you were talking about El Capone and the prohibition, and I love that example. So when you actually have this kind of you know, like a restrictive regulators, don't they see the point? I mean,
no, they don't, because look, I won't single anyone out and accuse them of something without giving them an opportunity to defend themselves, but how many have heard of Charles Lafer? How many of them understand the basics, the math in our industry? How many of them are there because they love the industry and want the industry to be sustainable and safe? Most of them are there because it's a career move. Most of them are there because a political ally wants them to be there. not everybody categorizes gaming stroke gambling as entertainment. Some people see it as a sin. Now, I believe that everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but they're not entitled to tell me what I should do or what I should not do within the parameters of reasonable legislation. The task here is education, education, education. And it involves the stakeholders in the industry, the B2B operators, the B2C operators. It involves politics. And it, most of all, it needs to involve the customer. The customer needs to understand why he has to tell you his name, his date of birth, and his passport number or his tax ID. The customer has to feel that this is entertainment and understand the overall reasonable level of time. He's not going to win, but he's going to enjoy himself or herself. The operator has to listen to the customer. The operator has to educate the regulator. And we all vote for politicians, so that's a longer game, but that I'm a bit more suspect about the opportunity there. The other thing I think is that I have said before, and I still feel the same, and no disrespect to the authority or the group of industry people you were talking about. The industry is naive and lazy, and the real leaders of this industry do not talk enough. Behind closed doors and in open plenary about this, they hide from it. They try and minimize it. They try and ignore it.
But again, like you said yourself, like when you're there back 2006, you get arrested and all the things that happened there, and you're facing a potential 80 years in prison, of which you end up serving almost two in practice. This is scary shit, man. This is scary shit.
Like, that's political. That's the USA at that time. That's what the politicians wanted to do at that time. They wanted to scare everybody because they did not want to legalize online gambling. Now, and as I've said before about the Al Capone and the prohibition of alcohol, it's a historic bump in the road in the United States from my historic observation at high level. You know, it's typical. If you look at Germany, it's different. Germany have a regulatory framework. Taxation is very high. You know, their motivation to do that is different.
But okay, so if you look at Germany, what's happening there is that now with the high taxation, and there's, by the way, it's not just taxation, there are other limits on, you know, like the kind of promotions you're allowed to have, the kind of bets you're allowed to run, like that is very restrictive on the players themselves as well. And there's a lot of onus on the operators that comply with all the laws to actually make sure the players actually are acting within the framework, or else they can take huge financial and even personal risks on themselves. But then all that ends up happening in a country like Germany is that then you have a flourishing black market that's starting to grow. Because even for the player, they understand that they play a game at 88% RTP, because the house needs to actually protect itself and cover its costs with all of those additional costs that is created from that regulatory ecosystem, or they can just play at 86% RTP, and the difference is not measured from the bottom, you know, from zero to the 88. It's measured from the top, and 86 is a 4% for every dollar that you wager. You're paying 4 cents on average for that entertainment, and 88, you're paying three times as much. It's 300% more expensive to play in a regulatory setting. So the player themselves have a very, very easy choice to make here. Like, you know, do I want to pay three times as much for the same experience?
Well, then you just go back to the same thing. It's, what did I say? I said education, education, education. The German regulator needs to be educated. who should be educating the German regulator? But big player in Germany is called Tipico. It's now acquired by Allwyn this week. But that's who should be talking to the German regulator.
And do you think that's, you know, if you look at that role that we expect the large players within the market to take, do you think that this is something that, or are you aware of any that are actually willing to take this kind of a conversation?
Well, I think if you're asking me the players that are maybe not covered by the regulation that are in the market, nobody is willing to talk. You know, I'm the example of what happens when you talk if you're participating at that in that direction. It's not feasible. You know, everybody has to act responsibly. I look at this, and I look at this from a strategic perspective, and you can already feel the change. It's almost like climate change, I think. You know, eventually, everywhere that's willing to allow gambling or entertainment, digital entertainment, will regulate. Eventually, regulation will harmonize because market competitiveness will drive that harmonization. But it can only happen with dialogue and education. It will take 20 years. It's not going to take 5 minutes. But if you go back 10 years from where you are today, you wouldn't imagine the momentum for regulation that seems to be in the wind in the last 12 months. You know, it is definitely blowing in that direction. Well, you mentioned iGaming Next. iGaming Next put out a podcast or a statement about their view of the future. And it's, you know, black markets are gone. Gray markets are going. Regulation is the way forward. And it is the way forward. Now, that will not eradicate black markets. It will not eradicate even gray markets. But instead of them being the majority, it will minimize them, and it will take time. That will take 5 years itself. You look at the Chinese market. The Chinese market was humongous. The Chinese market is still sizable, but it's not 20% what it was 5 years ago because they take measures to stop it. They take a different view from regulation, unless you're in Macau.
Yeah, that creates, we get the El Capone phenomenon all over again, right? It creates huge incentives for operators to, or for say of some operators to act in, you know, to act in unlawfully, because then
but that's because some economies have different priorities and different contextual things to deal with. If you're President Z, gambling is not your number one priority. No, you're still elevating poor people to substance. You're still creating huge infrastructure. You're dealing with geopolitical dynamics that could be World War III. You know, gambling's not high on his priority list. And the reason that gambling gets squeezed in China is because of the outflow of cash. Not because it's gambling. If it was gambling, there would be no Macau. But there is Macau.
But you know, I think that if you look at Chinese culture in general, like gambling, even playing mahjong, you know, they have like these little even government-run kiosks where you can play things that kind of look a little bit like a slot machine. I think
you can even do lottery part. In China. Yeah, it's a big part
of their culture. Chinese love to take a punt; they love it. You know, we can even see in Australia. We have many Australians of Chinese descent, and they love, you know, they love taking a punt. You know, not just in the clubs and the pubs, but you know, like if in a tab on the horse races, on the dog races, and it's like it's a big part of the culture. And I think to kind of connect to what you said earlier, it's, if you view it as sin, right, like gambling is bad and we need to eliminate this, it's actually ignoring a big part of human nature that we like that dance with chance, that dance with randomness. It's deeply rooted in all living creatures, even with pigeons, even with rats. They love randomness too. So expecting, you know, the human species to ignore something that is so deeply rooted in our psyche is a problem, you know? So, and I think that becomes like, yeah, like you said, it becomes more of a, almost at a religious level. It's a war on sin rather than trying to think, okay, this is just entertainment. And how do we actually manage it like any other form of entertainment?
Well, I repeat myself again, education. It's the only way you can challenge someone that has an opinion that is the opposite of you. Now, some you will win, some you will lose, some you will move a little bit, some you will make even more determined to beat you. But it's life. That is life. We just have to accept that. You know what? We run businesses. Businesses make money, but they do much more than make money. They create creativity. They create employment. Employment creates more people. More people creates more opportunity. Somebody whose father worked in a betting shop might go to university and invent the cure for XYZ. You never know. That's the reality here.
I completely agree, but the creativity, I think that the creative output of iGaming in all areas, down to from the art of games, it's beautiful things that are made to you know the engaging with players, creating entertainment around this. I watched at the end of playing a Nintendo game. At the end of the Nintendo, when I finished the game, there was this credits running, and it says everyone who were involved, down to software engineer this and I was thinking, I've never seen that in one of the slot machines I've made. Rest of something runs at the end, or even at the helper was saying,
No time for that. Let me share something with you. I think you'll find the music. Okay. That creativity thing, that is driven by customer demand, customer behavior, customer desires. Go way back before the internet, even before television and betting shops. In betting shops in the United Kingdom, we used to have a broadcast system. It was called Exchange Telegraph. Exchange Telegraph used to broadcast the commentary on the horse race or the dog race from Walthamstow or from Epsom or wherever it was from. It was regionalized. So it would come from the racecourse and someone would listen and then regurgitate. And the person covering Scotland would interpret the base commentary in a different way to the person in Norwich. I've heard both. One, there's an accent difference. Two, there's a pace of talk difference. And three, there's probably 50 meters difference in terms of where the horses are from beginning to end. And in the Scottish version, it was always tremendously exciting. You were standing in the betting shop, listening, looking at the whiteboard, and you still thought your horse had a chance of winning with 10 seconds to go. The reality was the winner was probably already decided if you actually saw the race on television. And the customers loved it. The customers were cheering and laughing and screaming and yelling, and they loved it.
Now, it reminds me of the world's, the World Cup, watching the World Cup and then watching the Brazilian broadcast talking about the game, and it sounds like the most exciting thing. And then you watch like maybe the one from the UK and you think that they're having
different tea. Yeah, But our industry have emulated that in different products and different things. That, the live show games, the drop ball, the color ball, with the girls and gentlemen talking and laughing and singing and everything. It's the same thing. It's what customers want. They want to be entertained, but they want to have some kind of cliff where they win a fortune or they have to try again. It's not new. the same thing, just regurgitated with new technology, fresh ideas, evolution. And it will continue to do that.
And at scale, I'd say, you know, the scale is...
Yes, yes. Well, that allows you to be very creative with prize giving, very creative with profit distribution, etc.
So I want to talk a little bit about the incentives. Like you say that you think that eventually the industry, from the regulatory perspective, start harmonizing. I think that something that is often missed is that from our point of view, as you know, from RubyPlay as a B2B content supplier, for B2C companies, for sports books and casinos, is that in many ways, being white is actually a lot better than not. Like, because if you want to eat, like the dream of many companies is to become listed companies, is to become publicly traded, is to bring investor money in. This is where you can see a huge financial gains for companies like this. And then, you know, the multipliers on your profits on money made in white markets is much more significant. The risk associated with this kind of revenue is much lower than gray or black markets, which often get discounted completely from your books when you go to some kind of a IPO proceeding.
A valuation model, yes, that's normal.
Yes,
I mean, and also it's right, because you know, if you go back to 2006, only one service provider got into trouble regarding Beno Sports, only one. Another platform provider, none of the games providers, only NetTeller. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, NetTeller. I thought I'd said Netflix. Sorry, NetTeller. Only NetTeller. Only NetTeller got into trouble. And NetTeller paid 119 million. No longer any trouble. B2B businesses need to be regulated. B2B businesses need to meet the standards. B2B businesses need to be transparent.
And they want to be. They want to.
Good. Good.
I think because this is how you end up, you know, creating a lot of value.
It's part of the player protection insurance. Integrity is everything. And that goes across all businesses. Doesn't matter what industry you're in. Integrity is everything. This is one reason that I speak like this on events like this. I tell the truth, even if the truth is ugly, and it's okay to disagree with me. I'm happy to chat to you. I'm happier to listen to you, because every time I listen to a counter-argument, I learn something.
But you see, I think also the incentives from the industry to players, right? Like the idea or the villainizing of the industry, saying, okay, like we just want to grab players' money as quickly as we can, deplete their wallet. It actually doesn't make sense if you think about this. What we want is a long-term relationship, a trusting relationship with the player. I would much rather you spend a few dollars with me a day over a lifetime than just spend $1,000 in a single week, realize that this is something you cannot afford, and then I lose you. The cost of bringing a single player is so phenomenal. Like it can
There's
be hundreds of dollars.
Sustainability. The word is sustainability. The black market is not sustainable because, one, it's against the law. Two, it takes advantage of customers. Three, there's no incentive to evolve and give something different, creative, blah, 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 because you're already making money. It's already easy. You know, I used to joke and I used to say to people, you could have taken your grandmother with me to Costa Rica, given her a server, and she'd be a millionaire. And in 2000, that was true, because all you had to do is plug it in and switch it on, and you would get money. Nowadays, it's not true. It's very different. You have to be proper business orientated, technically savvy, commercially smart, politically astute, etc., etc.
Yeah, it's a tough business.
The biggest challenge will be in the next 5 years in this industry will be jurisdictions like where you reside at the moment, where there is a regulatory environment that internationalizes opportunity. That rather conflicts with independent regulation by country. And their sustainability as hubs might come into question for a regulatory issue rather than a logistical issue. You know, I have lived in Malta. I know how busy it is. I know how bad the traffic is. But I also know how, you know, how the history of the country is amazing, you know, for example. It's a nice place, but it's challenging for some.
So, David, I think we do both agree that the right direction is white, you know, like saying white is the new black. Really, we all want that. We all want the industry to regulate. We all want the industry to educate.
Can I make a suggestion? And it's not trying to make a joke or continue something I said it about a year ago. But like, I think the new white is purple. Okay, it's not because it's no longer white, but it's because it includes everybody. It includes the service providers, not just the games developers. It includes the payments providers. It includes the marketing. It includes the affiliates. It includes the technology developers, the banking service, everything. Because unless you comply, unless you meet the standard, you are not sustainable.
I completely agree. I completely agree with the statement. I like that. The new white is purple. Okay, David, thanks a lot for joining me today for this really cool conversation. I really enjoyed it. And I hope that we'll see more honest conversations around this with regulators and a thriving ecosystem working with regulators rather than against them, wherever they're open to it. Yeah.
So thank you for the invitation, and I wish you and Ruby Play all the very best.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of IGB Podcast, iGaming Checkup with Dr. Eyal. There's plenty more to come, so stay with us for more eye-opening, thought-provoking, and stigma-challenging conversations that dig deeper into the world of iGaming.